Give the Valentine's Day gift that lasts as long as you want. Foot Cardigan will deliver a random pair of awesome socks to your booze mailbox every single month for 3, 6, 9, or 12 month pay once subscriptions. Boom, you just saved Valentine's Day. So get 10% off of any Foot Cardigan subscription by going to footcardigan.com and entering cracked16, that's CRACKED16, at checkout, and you'll save Valentine's Day, you'll save your relationship, and you'll save humanity all at once. This episode is also sponsored by howl.fm, that's howl.fm. Guys, so episode 2 of my show, Good Question with Jack O'Brien, is up, in which I tell you whether aliens helped build the pyramids by talking to two of my favorite historians. Obviously, the answer is no. Don't worry if you download the episode. It's not just me being like, hey, welcome to the episode. No. All right. Thanks for listening. We use it as more of a jumping off point for me to talk to two of my favorite historians. Charles Mann, the author of 1491, is one of them. And probably two of the most interesting conversations. It would rank as one of my favorite episodes of this podcast if it were this podcast, but it's not. You have to go to howl.fm, download the app. It's like Netflix for podcasts, basically. And if you subscribe to Howl Premium for just $4.99 a month, you also get ad-free versions of every Earwolf and Wolf Pop show. Anyways, go listen to it. That's Howl, howl.fm, or, you know, search Howl in the iTunes App Store. You know how technology works. Go to either of those places and use the promo code CRACKED to get a free month of Howl Premium. Sweet summer night and I'm stripped to my sheets. 4 minutes leak and my AC squeaks. And a voice from the clock says you're not gonna get tired. My bed is a pool. Hello, the internet, and welcome to another episode of the Cracked Podcast. My name's Jack O'Brien. I'm the editor-in-chief of Cracked. And this week we're listening to Summertime Clothes by Animal Collective. It's a song about not being able to sleep because it's too hot and going out and meeting up with a friend. I've always loved the song. Lyrically, it's always reminded me of sneaking out of a friend's house at night when we were kids, walking down the middle of the street of our pitch dark suburb. We'd go to the houses of girls we had crushes on or meet up with some friends from our class and just generally get into trouble, just generally be shitty kids. I think I smoked my first cigarette on the curb outside my neighborhood pool at 3 a.m. on one of these kind of covert missions. If you saw car lights coming, you'd run away into the yards. And on the few occasions when cops chased us, we never got caught because we knew which yards had motion sensor lights and that the creek runoff tunnel that never had any water in it was the best place to hide. And the stakes felt life or death to me at that time. But by the time I was in high school, I was convinced that the worst that would have happened to any of us would have been getting grounded, I think. And I'm no longer so sure about that because of the industry that we're talking about today. It's an industry that until a couple years ago, I didn't even know existed. We've been doing these personal experience articles on the site for a few years now. Robert Evans, one of our editors, invented this new type of content a few years ago where he and his team go out and talk to people about interesting experiences they've had. We've talked to a prison guard who told us what it's like coming to work in a place where the people who live there have nothing to do but watch you and talk to each other about ways to murder you when you're least expecting it. Basically, like Vietnam under fluorescent lights is how he described it. Speaking of which, we even talked to someone who fought on the other side, fought with the Viet Cong during the Vietnam War, which he said was a lot like being a prison guard at a maximum security penitentiary. No, he had an incredible, heartbreaking story to tell. He went away to war to fight for his small village and returned from war, and it wasn't there. Anyways, as you can tell, I'm a big fan of what Robert and his team are doing, but one of the strangest experiences that we keep coming across are teenagers whose parents paid to have them kidnapped and taken away to be tortured for long periods of time. It's called the troubled teen industry. These are kids who are caught smoking pot or who are getting bad grades in some cases, caught sneaking out of their houses, maybe. Just think about the worst thing you got away with as a teenager. Some kids had this happen to them for talking back to their parents or a new step-parent who they didn't get along with. And then one night, they're sleeping in their beds and a group of strangers, muscle-bound, big, bouncer-type strangers with handcuffs burst into their bedroom, physically pull them out of their bed, and put them in an unmarked van. Unmarked because they're not cops. They're just, I guess, professional kidnappers, basically. Like the European guys from Taken, if those European kidnappers had a website. Because, yeah, there's an actual website we'll talk about on today's episode that you can check out at any time during the episode. SafeYouth.com, where it essentially says, hey, we'll take your kids against their will. Just don't tell them we're coming, because that makes our jobs easier. We like to use the element of surprise and disorientation, among other things. And these kids are taken away from their homes, thrown into these facilities that the environment in these places can range from Lord of the Flies, just, you know, John Locke's state of nature with children, to Soviet police state during the 1950s, where everybody is spying on everybody else and there's no food and there's like a rigid power structure. None of these things is in the brochure, of course. The brochure makes it seem like a year-long summer camp mixed with the Dr. Phil show. But there have been enough investigations that have shut enough of these places down for people to realize that it's not a good idea to have an unregulated business in charge of a bunch of young men and women who, some of them are, you know, emotionally damaged. Some of them just got caught doing something really innocuous. The one thing they all have in common, though, is that their parents don't believe a word of what they have to say. It's not surprising that sometimes they're sexually abused. A lot of times they're physically abused. Sometimes they're tortured. Sometimes they're starved to death. And once they get there, they aren't allowed to use the internet. Their letters home are red and torn up if they complain. Their phone calls, they have like someone standing over them. You know, the kids who always get good grades and never disobey their parents don't have to worry about this. They get to grow up and become stockbrokers and accountants. But our future musicians and artists and writers are being stolen out of their beds and, you know, having the spirit just beat out of them by Ben Stiller in Happy Gilmore and the prison guard from Shawshank. Because they're shitty, rich parents, the places are extremely expensive, which is how I know they're rich. Because they're shitty, rich parents don't want to deal with them. And this is the sort of thing you read about in dystopian novels or novels about World War I era British school kids sent off to boarding schools. But it's happening right now in America. If you grew up in a rich family, it could have happened to you. If you had got caught every time you did something wrong and the right school counselor or, you know, church youth minister had gotten your parents' ear on the right day, if you're under 18, they could still be your stories. Google troubled teen right now, and you'll find these places. School for defiant teens. Help for parents of troubled teens. Anyways, up first, Robert Evans and I are going to talk to a journalist named Maya Salibitz, who wrote the book on this subject, literally. And then halfway through, we're going to switch over to talking to someone who is actually in one of these programs. So hope you are as shocked and furious about what you're about to hear as I was. I'll be back at the end for some footnotes. Talk to you then. Walking around in our summertime clothes. No
Maya, so you wrote Help at Any Cost, which is kind of the book that sort of started public knowledge in a lot of ways about what was going on in these places. You want to get into kind of why you started following this story, how you became aware of what was going on?
Sure. Basically, I had a drug addiction myself in my 20s, and one of the reasons I did not seek help sooner than I ended up seeking help was because I had read about some of these programs, and I'd read about the public humiliation and the attacks and the shaming, and I thought, wow, like, that would make me want to get high. That wouldn't help me recover. Why would I go there? I knew that the presence of this kind of methodology in addiction treatment existed, and I wondered where it came from. And so when I did get into recovery and I was working as a reporter, it was sort of natural to investigate this further, especially since I continued to hear horror stories about this kind of treatment from people. And people didn't really seem to understand that it was not a case of there's one bad program or one bad employee, but that the abuse itself was the treatment. And I think that's what my book added to the debate, aside from giving a history as well, is just to put it all together and say, wait a minute, this isn't accidental abuse. The abuse is a deliberate part of what they're trying to do here. One of the things that shocked me about the troubled teen industry was this business of so-called escorts. And that is a group of unregulated people who are hired to deliberately kidnap teenagers from their beds at 2 in the morning for maximum disorientation and take them to these programs. The idea is supposed to be if the kid knew they were going, they would run away, so we have to, you know, bring it on them. But the reality is that this is incredibly traumatic. And I was shocked that anybody could possibly think this was a good idea. The research on what works in treatment for every type of psychological disorder ever studied is that empathy and rapport between the client and the therapist is, like, critical to recovery. So this is obviously not a way to build a trusting relationship. And it is also, kidnapped people suffer post-traumatic stress disorder all the time. And here you have a situation in which kids are being kidnapped out of their beds at 3 a.m. Their parents are standing by. Nobody tells them what's going to happen. They don't know how long they will be in the place where they are going. And we've known for centuries that indefinite sentences are traumatic and difficult. So it's basically all of this comes together to create an experience that is not healing at all and that creates trauma. And what I wanted to do was find out, where the hell did we get this dumb idea and why does it continue to thrive?
Yeah, I think our first article on the subject described it as basically the kidnapping and Taken if it had turned out that Liam Neeson was responsible for the kidnapping in the end. Can you give me a range of, like, problems, most to least serious, that you've seen this treatment used for?
Everything from, like, getting bad grades to telling your parents to F off to
holy
bipolar
shit.
Disorder or severe addictions or personality disorders. Basically, the thing that is astonishing about this to me in the 21st century is that we have this concept of a troubled teen, and we think the kid with Asperger's and the kid who has just lost his parent to depression and the kid who is shooting up in the corner and the kid who is delusional can all be fixed by the same thing. This is just nuts. With any other area of medicine, you would treat people according to an actual diagnosis. But basically, the only way people are diagnosed in these programs is they do what some doctors call a wallet biopsy. And if it comes up positive and the parents can afford it, they will let the kid in.
First of all, not only are they all treating the different problems with the same treatment, but it sounds like the treatment itself is not the right treatment for literally any of those things.
No, I mean, the idea that you can treat depression by attacking and breaking people is as silly as the idea that you can treat Asperger's by attacking and breaking people. The research shows quite clearly that we're quite good at breaking people down. If you kidnap somebody, attack them, humiliate them, keep them in isolation, make sure that they can't trust their peers because the peers' advancement in the program and their own ability to go home is based on betraying each other. You know, food deprivation, sleep deprivation, you do all these things and it's pretty easy to break somebody and to create post-traumatic stress disorder and to create compliance that lasts about 6 months. But this is not good for any type of mental health. There are certainly people who survive trauma and do very well, but nobody anywhere, aside from these crazy places, believes that traumatizing people is a useful way to create mental health.
How is this idea first introduced to parents? Why didn't my parents, when I went out and got drunk when I was 13 and got caught because I was terrible at being a teenager, why did my parents not know about this option, whereas these other kids' parents do? Is it just like a thing that like spreads virally through the community?
Well, here's the thing. When a kid has a psychological problem or a drug problem, parents tend to be embarrassed by it. In contrast, if your kid has cancer, you call up Aunt Susie and you call grandma and you find out, you know, who has a cousin that works at Sloan Kettering and you mobilize everybody and you find out, okay, what's the best possible care for this particular kind of cancer? But if your kid is acting out, you're blaming yourself and you're thinking you did something wrong and you don't want anybody to know. So you search on the internet in the middle of the night and you find this place that like has all these smiling faces on it and immediately promises to fix your kid for you. So the idea for this in the very first place originated in an organization that turned into a cult called Synanon. And they managed to get public attention with their claim that they could cure heroin addiction. And at the time, people didn't believe heroin addiction was curable. So suddenly it was this miracle thing and Hollywood came rushing and all the police departments and state health departments came rushing and everybody went and replicated it before realizing that it actually didn't work. And still today, in a lot of addiction treatment, as well as the troubled teen industry, this ideology lives on. And it comes from the idea that if you have an addiction, you must be forced to hit bottom, and you must be forced to be broken, and you must break down your tough, denying street identity to make you comply, and that your problem is just that you haven't been punished enough. And we know that this is absolutely not true now. You know, we might not have known this as well as we know it now, but in four decades, there's never been a single positive study of this stuff. And, you know, it's quite clear now that if punishment cured addiction, addiction wouldn't exist because addiction is itself defined by compulsive behavior despite negative consequences. So it comes from this crazy, ridiculous idea that if we just get tough enough with these evil people, we can break them and rebuild them, you know, as new beings.
What are some of the worst things that you've seen, worst conditions or worst methodologies you've seen?
Pretty much everything short of waterboarding. I mean, it's shocking. Literally people who are, like, chained for hours, who are deprived of sleep for days, who are beaten senseless, who are, you know, ignored when they have medical conditions that clearly require help. People have died in that situation. You've had people made to eat their own vomit, gagged with Kotex. Real torture stuff here. This is not just, you know, a little bit of, oh, let's yell in the kid's face. The thing, however, that tends to be the most damaging is actually the climate of emotional abuse and the ideology that teaches these kids that, you know, the best way to help somebody is to attack them. And, you know, if your girlfriend asks, do I look fat in this, the best way to help her is to say, yes, you look fat in that. And this obviously makes for a very good social life after you come out.
Right. How many teens are out there in one of these programs right now?
Well, it's hard to know because they're not regulated. And, you know, over the last 10 years or so, people have really fought to try to get federal regulation of these places, but nothing gets through Congress these days, so that really hasn't happened. So nobody really knows. The thing is, the good news is that since 2008, the industry has contracted enormously. Once people could no longer mortgage their homes in order to pay for this stuff, they couldn't afford it, so a lot of the places closed. Some of the worst offenders, like most but not all of the WASP programs, which were this big network of programs. It was called the Worldwide Association of Specialty Schools and Programs, and they treated thousands of people, or mistreated, I should say. You know, that closed. Aspen Education, which used to run many of these places, including one where they were actually making people do lap dances, that one, ironically enough, was called Mount Bachelor Academy. But anyway, that got shut down.
What do you mean they were making students do lap dances?
So basically, they have these seminars where the idea is to publicly humiliate you as much as possible. And so they made girls who had been sexually abused do lap dances for boys, supposedly to stop them from wanting to be promiscuous. This logic escapes me. I do not understand how making people reenact their trauma in a disgusting way, and they literally have the boys yell slut and whore at these poor girls. It just boggles the mind that anybody would think this would possibly be a good idea. But, you know, I wrote about it in Time Magazine's website, and the state of, I always space whether it's Oregon or Washington, but whichever state it was, went in, did an investigation, and found that this indeed had happened, and these kids were not lying, and that they were doing these so-called psychodramas. I mean, they literally found bed sheets that were from these psychodrama seminars. I think one of them said something like, "I'm the yes girl, spray your cum all over my tits." And this was written by the kids, like, you know, as some kind of graffiti. This was stuff that they were made to write by the adults.
Jesus.
The amazing thing was that the adults were like, "This is psychodrama. You just don't understand."
You know, you were saying it escapes you how that could seem like a good idea. I mean, it sounds like these are sexual predators, the adults in this case.
Yes, I do think that that's some of it. And I also think that, you know, in the 70s, a lot of adults did think this kind of radical honesty crap was a good idea. Like, a lot of adults paid good money to be locked up and sleep-deprived and not allowed to go to the bathroom and go through these supposedly liberating seminars. Like, it was a big thing in the 70s. It escapes me why people would think this was good, but what tends to happen, and this is a real psychological phenomenon that's been studied a lot, is that if you're made to go through an awful experience, you tend to rationalize it. So, like, if, you know, something terrible happens to you, like you're, you know, in the Holocaust or something, you might come out of it and say, "Well, that was the worst thing ever, but at least I learned X, Y, and Z." And these programs take from that, well, we should do the Holocaust to make people learn something. It's that insane. But the reality is that once you, you know, like, I mean, there's all these interesting studies where, like, if you make people pay, like, a ton of money for really bad food, they'll say it's good. Or if you make people do something slightly embarrassing in order to get to a really boring support group, they'll think the support group is interesting. So, you know, this is why fraternity initiations create bonding. And so they use this to basically end up having kids come out of there and say, "I needed this. This helped me." And, you know, it's just evil on so many levels. But yes, I think there are also genuine sexual predators who, if you were a sexual predator, why wouldn't you set up one of these places? You tell the parents, expect bizarre reports of abuse, but don't believe them. That's just your lying, manipulative kid. If you are somebody who enjoys sexually humiliating children in public, you can do this. You can get away with it for years. If you get caught in one state, you can just go to another state, and you can sell your perversion as therapy. And astonishingly, you can even convince some genuinely good people that this stuff is a good idea. And it's the same way that cults work. You know, you create a sort of intensely stressful bonding kind of experience, and you tell people it's incredibly meaningful and it's changed your life. And in order to make sense of it, people come around and support it.
And I guess I see the appeal to parents in that it makes a embarrassing problem, something they see as an embarrassing problem, just disappear from their lives, and they get to feel like, oh, we did the right thing, and now I can just sleep well at night knowing my kid is in the care of professionals. But I mean, I think something that might be difficult for the listener to understand is, like, why these kids don't just tell their parents they're being horribly abused.
Well, there's two reasons for that.
Sure.
Like, the first one is that they cut you off from internet access, and any phone calls you make are monitored. And if you start to say something, they simply hang up the phone. and you get punished by isolation or stress positions or, you know, starvation or just more emotional attacks or spending more time in the program. So you very quickly learn if you want to get out of there, you better comply. So that's one reason. The other reason is that they tell the parents, expect bizarre reports of abuse, but that's just your kid trying to manipulate you. Don't believe it. And since in some cases these kids have been lying to their parents, that's very easy for the parents to buy into. And so that makes it impossible for abuse to be reported.
That is like Kafka-esque, just like a fucking existential nightmare of like...
No, and I mean, yeah. It's like, it's really the way the whole system works is terrifying. And one of the things that I found shocking when I was working on this book and just reporting in this area is that literally tens of thousands of American kids have been through this. If I go to a party and I talk to, you know, the little circle of four or five people that you talk to at a party, one of those people will either have been sent themselves, have a relative that was sent, or know somebody, you know, like a classmate that was sent. I mean, it's like, it's a very, very common experience for people to have, and yet it's one that so few people know about, and it's basically got less regulation on it than nail salons in most states.
I mean, growing up, I guess I had heard people say, your dad's going to send him off to the military academy, and I guess I thought that that was something that was possible, but not really, and it seems like this is like an entire industry of where those kids get sent. We've talked to people before who've run away from the camps, right?
Yeah, we talked to one guy who ran away from a wilderness camp, and as far as I know, is the only person who actually succeeded in escaping from one of those, and he essentially had to walk for like a couple of days straight because it was in the middle of nowhere.
What's even scarier about this is that, you know, they sell the parents, they tell them that, you know, we have success, 90% success rates, we're professionals, we know what we're doing, we've dealt with these kids a million times. But the people who are actually working with the kids don't even need to have a high school education. And there's no background check. So you do get a lot of sexual predators, and the parents are thinking, oh, my kid is much safer than they would be on the street, they won't be getting into drugs or whatever. Meanwhile, oftentimes, they have the kids distribute the psych drugs themselves, and the staff is completely not trained, and, you know, it's just a money-making operation.
You were saying that the industry contracted when the economy slowed down. It's just interesting that it was almost this luxury good. You know, if you're wealthy enough, you can just make your troubled teenager go away.
I talked to a lot of people who basically were sent away because the new step-parent didn't want them around.
Oh, my God.
And that was really horrifying. I remember distinctly talking to one girl, and, you know, the stepmother sounded like something out of Cinderella, where she just wanted to get this child out of the way so that she could get the money from the father who was rich. And the girl didn't even have a problem. I mean, there's just, like, there's a lot of crazy stuff that goes on because basically people under 18 have no rights. If your parents want to send you to one of these places, you can be stuck in that place without any means of escape and without any means of communication until you're 18 completely legally.
That's incredible. Robert, you have any stuff for Maya?
I mean, one thing that we kind of talked about a lot with our last source that's always struck me as particularly interesting is how important it is to have sort of the buy-in of the other kids in order to perpetuate these, because some of these former students are both a big part of, like, the marketing for these schools, and also, like, while they're still in the treatment centers, a significant amount of the discipline involves tattling on each other and discipline from, like, kids who've been in the program longer.
Yep, and, I mean, that is one of the most insidious things about this, because it makes the victims into perpetrators themselves. And so then they feel complicit, and they are more likely to buy in because they think, well, why did I do that horrible abuse to, you know, why did I do something that I know was painful to me to someone else just in order to, like, save my own self? So the best way to, like, come up with that and rationalize that is just to say, oh, well, I needed it done to me, that kid needed it done to them, and this is, you know, helpful and good, and let's, like, sell it to other people. So, yeah, that aspect of it is horrifying. The other horrifying part of that is that it teaches kids a very cynical way of seeing other people as things to be manipulated. I mean, it really teaches a very sociopathic worldview. It's like helping people is hurting them, and enforcing power on vulnerable people is good for them. You are always right. The person who has the power is always right. I mean, these are terrible lessons. This is also like, don't think for yourself, because if you think for yourself, you will be attacked. I mean, this is not what you want as college prep.
Can you talk about just any of the sort of really insidious structures that you saw set up? Because some of the ones that I've seen detailed really seem like it oscillates between Lord of the Flies and like a Orwellian 1984 type thing where everybody's spying on everybody else.
That's the way to create compliance. You basically make it so that you can't trust anybody, and so that your own survival in the place is predicated on betraying other people. So this makes the social support that would normally buffer you from being traumatized impossible to get. Because not only do you not have your parents or anybody that you know, your peers are trying to, like, go home too. And so, yeah, I mean, it's a terrible, terrible way of treating people. And it's every person for themselves. And it is just horrible. There is nothing that is mentally healthy about it.
And aren't there specific schools that have really horrifying legacies where a bunch of different graduates, I guess, have gone on to commit crimes? Or
I know, you know, the Elon School was one of the most horrifying and the most violent. Straight was also pretty violent, but Elon was kind of, I mean, it was just racist, misogynist, and just throwing people against walls and pouring horrible, gross sauce on them and just doing, you know, it was just awful. So, you know, there was a case where a girl who was sent there met through the program, when she got out, you know, through somebody she met in the program, she met a guy who started pimping her out, and they murdered a girl together. There are a couple of people, and remember, because these places are expensive, most of the people who are in them are, like, at least middle class. So this is rare to end up middle class and on death row, but there were at least three people from straight or straight descendant programs that did end up on death row for murders. And there was at least one case of a person, I think from a WASP program, who either hired somebody to kill his parents or did it himself. And there was also another WASP participant on death row that I actually interviewed. It really doesn't help people, and it makes the people who are sociopathic and who are dangerous more dangerous, not less so.
It turns actual troubled teens into real problems for society, it sounds like. Did the person who you interviewed who ended up on death row, did he say that that experience had something to do with his life?
Oh, yeah. I mean, like, because, I mean, it was pretty direct, because he left the WASP program when he was 18, and his parents had done the thing, like, we'll cut you off unless you graduate it. And so, like, he was homeless, and, you know, they had given him $50 and a bus ticket or something like this. And that's how he ended up in the circumstances in which he committed the crime. I got the sense that he was very, very messed up long before he went there, and that he was probably guilty of the crime, but I don't think his defense served him well by not bringing up the experiences that he'd had in this place, and that this could well have made an already very troubled person worse.
We get high in backseat circles, we break into mobile homes, we go to sleep to shake a pill.
Hey folks, we're listening to The Way We Get By off of Spoon's record Kill the Moonlight, which is one of my favorite records of my 20s. We talked a bit about Spoon on last week's episode, which I think is why I was thinking about them and listening to them this week. And this would probably be maybe my first choice if I were to create a soundtrack for a movie about what it's like to be a shitty teenage troublemaking misdemeanor criminal. What it feels like, the thoughts and feelings that kind of go through your mind. This and basically all of the Hold Steady's album Separation Sunday, which I've never quite been able to break down into the right 15 to 30 second chunks to include much of it on this podcast, unfortunately. But this Spoon album, Kill the Moonlight, that Hold Steady album, Separation Sunday, if people want to know what it felt like to be a late 20th century American teenager, they should play those albums for them. And maybe they will. The only reason we read Russian literature is because their recording instruments sucked, and Dostoevsky didn't have a rock band to join. Anyways, hope you enjoy this song and these words from our sponsors.
We go out in stormy weather. We rarely practice discern. We make love to some weird sin. We seek out the taciturn. Let's do where we get by, to where we get by.
This week's episode is brought to you by Loot Crate, a monthly subscription box service for geek and gamer items and pop culture gear. For less than $20 a month, you can get 4 to 8 items that include licensed gear, apparel, collectibles, and they guarantee $40 of value in every crate, sometimes more. And if you go to lootcrate.com/cracked and enter cracked at checkout, you can save $3 on any new subscription. As I mentioned at the top of the show, Valentine's Day is coming up. So show your special someone how much you care with this month's theme. Dead. Yes, Loot Crate is celebrating the return of The Walking Dead and the Deadpool movie by bringing you 5 exclusives in this month's crate. A t-shirt, 2 figures, and 2 other things that are so super secret I can't even tell you what they are, and they're definitely not human brains. Yes, definitely not human brains. So seriously, guys, if you're into the pop culture stuff we like to talk about all the time on Cracked, Loot Crate totally has you covered. And remember, the deal is you only have until the 19th at 9 p.m. Pacific to subscribe and receive that month's crate, because when the cutoff happens, that's it. It's over. So go to lootcrate.com/cracked and enter cracked to save $3 on your new subscription today. Guys, the Cracked Podcast is being sponsored by Stamps.com. Most of us are trying to find more time to get things done and be more organized, yet going to the post office is like visiting a black hole where not even light or time can escape. Think about it. There's never parking. There's always a huge line. You never know which little slip to fill out. Matthew McConaughey is there trying to get back to his kids. It's awful. Interstellar. There's a great 2-year-old reference for you. Anyways, quit going to the post office and wasting your time when you can buy and print official U.S. postage from home with Stamps.com. They even send you a digital scale, which automatically calculates the exact postage you need for any letter or package and any class of mail. You can also schedule pickups, so you can just print the label and hand it to your mail person with a smug smile on your face. And if you work from home, like a lot of our Cracked writers and employees and readers around the country, probably, it's just a priceless tool. So here's the special offer for Cracked listeners. Right now, sign up for Stamps.com and use my promo code, which is Cracked, for a 4-week trial plus a $110 bonus offer that includes free postage and a digital scale. So don't wait, go to Stamps.com, and before you do anything else, click on the microphone at the top of the page and type in Cracked. That's Stamps.com and enter Cracked.
We found a new kind of dance in a magazine. Try it out, it's like nothing you ever seen. You sweet talk like a cop, and you know it. You bought a new bag of pots, so let's make a new start. And that's the way to my heart.
Alright, so just kind of as the last thing, I'd love it if we could just kind of create a hypothetical case study of, so I have just been caught smoking pot or whatever it is, the listener, whatever the worst thing you got caught doing as an adolescent, and suddenly I'm woken up at 2 a.m. Can you kind of just, based on, you know, all the different stories you've heard, kind of take us through what maybe a really strange experience might go like?
I mean, what would basically happen is, like, several big guys, you know, with big muscles and handcuffs come into your bedroom in the middle of the night, grab you, refuse to tell you what's going on other than that you better come with them and you better comply. Your parents stand there and they say, oh, we love you, but they won't tell you what's going on either. You wind up in the wilderness far away from any civilization and, you know, pretty much if you're going to leave, you better know where you're going, otherwise you could actually die of exposure. You end up in the woods and you have very poor equipment. You are not given enough food. In some cases, you might actually have to eat lizards.
Wait, so when you say in the woods, these muscle-bound guys, like, take me on an airplane, and then we just drive out into the woods?
Basically, yes. I mean, some people are taken on airplanes. Some people are just taken on very long car rides. And one of the things that's especially shocking about this is there is a guy who, I don't know if he's still working in the business, but he never was taken out of the business as far as I know, but he admitted that he sexually abused his stepdaughter. And this guy was taking teenage girls out of their bed at 3 in the morning and keeping them overnight in hotel rooms in handcuffs and supposedly, you know, helping them get to these treatment centers. I mean, can you imagine if you found out that that's what you turned your child over to?
That's unbelievable. On the kidnapping, the actual kidnapping, because that seems like it's got to be the most traumatizing part. Are the parents always there, or are the parents sometimes just like, we're gonna stay in our bedroom?
I think they might sometimes do that, but I think that it's clear to the child that the parents are complicit in this.
Wow.
So that in itself is very traumatic, because you would hope that your parents would protect you from kidnappers, or at least be calling 911 or something. So, you know, and to me, what's also just horrifying about it is that they want to go for maximum disorientation. So they do it at 2 in the morning. And that's really like a psychological technique that is the start of this whole process of trying to break you. And breaking people is not a good thing to do. You know, we have not ever found that this is the way to make wonderful people.
So, okay, now I'm out in the woods in a log cabin or something?
No. And I mean, it's oftentimes, because a lot of these places are located in Utah, it's sort of the high desert, so it's not even woods, and that's why there are lizards there that you could eat. But yes, you have very poor camping equipment. If you cannot learn rapidly to make a fire with, you know, a stick, you will freeze. If it is hot, you are often not given enough water, and several kids have died of heat stroke and dehydration as a result of that. You know, so there's all manner of things that can go wrong. The main thing that has tended to kill people in these places is that when kids say, hey, I'm feeling sick, or I'm too hot, I can't move any further, they just say, you're lazy, go on, you're manipulating us, stop with that nonsense. I mean, in my book, I wrote about this horrible case of this young man called Aaron Bacon, who, over the course of several weeks, basically starved to death, and he was, like, unable to control his bodily functions, and they were making fun of him as he lay dying in his own, you know, and they just thought he was faking, and that the fact that he'd lost 30 pounds was just his manipulation. And they believed that until after he was dead and they couldn't resuscitate him.
Because so, they just weren't feeding him?
Yeah, because, like, he was not given the privilege of food or something. And also because he couldn't keep anything down, because he turned out to have an ulcer that could have been treated with an over-the-counter medication if they had treated it early enough.
That's horrifying.
You know, and so it's horrifying. And this kid was like, you know, I've read some of his poetry and stuff like this. He was the most lovely kid. His parents were lovely people. They totally did not want anything like this for him to undergo. They were just conned. Fortunately, today, with the internet, it is hard for parents to be, like, this happened right before the internet really got big. This was like in the 90s. Now, if you search for some of these places, on the first page, you will often see something about survivors and abuse. And it's very hard for parents to be as ignorant as they were in the past, which is a really good thing. Because basically, nowadays, those parents would never have sent their kid to such a place. But back then, there was no way for them to find out without, like, going through the archives of newspapers that these people had killed before.
Yeah, now parents know how to use Google, and so they might...
And I mean, that really, you know, the survivors have really done a great job of, you know, search engine work and just getting their stories out there so that, you know, if parents are ignorant of the fact that these programs have serious issues. It is their own fault. It is, you know, I mean, probably some of them can still get conned, but in most cases, it is not the way it was in the past, where genuinely concerned parents who were, you know, doing all the appropriate checking end up in this situation.
Sure. All right. So sorry, back to my hypothetical. Sleeping in a tent or something?
Yeah, if you get the privilege of having a tent.
Yeah, the kid we talked to spent most of his nights just out under the stars, which sounds nice when you're choosing to be there and it's not for weeks on end.
Right, and you're not freezing to death.
One of the things that is, you know, I mean, that I sort of think about is, like, I think it is quite possible that for a kid who, you know, is troubled and a little bit not confident and who likes the outdoors, to go on a sort of challenging wilderness adventure for kids who are just kids would probably be helpful.
Right.
It's just pretending that it's therapy and not believing the kids when they say, hey, you know, I'm in pain here, that causes all the problems. So, but in our hypothetical situation, what would end up happening is they have to hike a certain amount. If they don't hike, you know, as far as they're supposed to, everybody gets punished. You know, they have these therapy groups where they're supposed to reveal their feelings, and then they get a letter from their parents about how horrible they are.
Ugh.
They are supposed to write down all their sins and every sexual encounter they've ever had and psychologize every experience. And then after 6 weeks, the parents come and visit, and they, you know, they might actually get to graduate if they have been compliant enough. But then it's often sprung on them that the next step is a emotional growth boarding school where they will go for the next few years.
Wow.
And what's amazing is, like, one of the ways that the programs sell parents on this is they say, oh, it's a wilderness program. It's only a month or 3 months. And then without fail, at the end of those 3 months, the kid needs more treatment and they must go to an emotional growth boarding school. And, gee, we just happen to have one that we also make money from.
Which they probably don't tell the parents. They probably just...
Which they don't disclose, exactly.
Right.
Yes, and your kid will die if you don't do this.
That's why our source who escaped chose to escape, is because he became aware of the fact that he was going to be essentially forced to go to one of these programs, and he wasn't going to actually get to go home at the end of his three-month time.
It really is terrible all around. But, you know, I mean, in the optimal situation, you go to a wilderness program and you get decent equipment at least, and the counselors aren't aimed at humiliating you, and, you know, you do learn that you can survive in the woods and that lizards don't taste that bad, but this is just not a good idea.
It feels like that I could still see young women being sent away to these things by their strong, hard-headed fathers
to this day. And, I mean,
and they seem to be at the biggest risk.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of this is driven by fear of teenage sexuality, particularly female. A lot of these programs also do so-called gay conversion, where they're trying to, you know, make kids who are gender nonconforming or gay or both into heterosexuals. And they try to do this through the same exact techniques of humiliation. They dress people in drag. They do all kinds of, you know, shaming things. And if the girl is sort of butch, they make her dress up in heels and all of that stuff. Basically, they teach that teenagers should not have sex or relationships, which is developmentally inappropriate. And, you know, they basically make them feel guilty even about the most normal vanilla sexual behavior.
Yeah, it's insane. It's crazy that this could still exist in America, in any country. All right, that was our conversation with Maya. And up next, Evans and I spoke with Sarah Cummins, who actually went to one of these programs. Her story is actually on the mild side compared to some of the other stories we've heard, and still pretty fucked up. One of the craziest stories we heard will actually take up the entirety of a future episode, but to give you a taste of what it was actually like to actually go to one of these, here is our conversation with Sarah Cummins. I'll be back at the end for footnotes. Talk to you then. That's the way we get by, so the way we get by, so the way. That's the way we get by. That's
probably best for you to give us kind of like a brief overview of your experience at this center, how long you were there and kind of why your parents sent you there in the first place.
Yeah, I mean, if we could even just start at what the experience of you even finding out that you were going there, how that all happened.
I actually knew I was going there. I was part of the process to help pick the center. I have basically the ABCDEFGs of diagnoses, but at the time I was really young when I was diagnosed with bipolar, and the suicidal part of it kicked in very early. So I tried to commit suicide freshman year.
Okay.
And then I tried treatment at home for about a year, and then we started looking into outpatient treatments.
And you're like 13, 14 at that time?
Yes, I was 15 when this process started, 14 when the whole thing really began.
Got it.
And we went through what's called an educational consultant. There's actually kind of a business where I would call it more of a racket, where they hook up parents and children with wilderness programs.
She just mentioned wilderness treatment programs. We did an article last year with a guy who went to one of those. And essentially, those are, well, they take you out with a group of kids into the desert, and you spend days, weeks, sometimes months at a time, just sort of hiking around with a couple of quote-unquote teachers, therapists who don't actually have any training in dealing with all the myriad health issues that kids can have when they're hiking through the desert for weeks on end. So it's not at all uncommon for kids to die in these sort of wilderness rehab centers.
It's a thing that's treated as a recourse for behavioral problems or mental health issues, right? These wilderness
programs?
Yeah,
the kid that we spoke with, who actually wound up escaping the center at one point, had been sent there because he was caught selling pot. So that was his parents' solution to him selling pot, was to send him to go be in the desert with some unqualified people for months and months at a time. And that same program he was in had killed some kids on several prior occasions. It's not uncommon for kids to die in wilderness rehab programs.
And so, Sarah, you were working with a consultant who kind of specializes in these rehabilitation behavioral type camps, right?
Her whole job was placing teenagers in any sort of therapeutic setting.
Did you know somebody who had been to one of these treatment centers? Or
what had happened was, my mother is a teacher, and one of her coworkers had sent her son away to wilderness, and that was where my mom heard about it and got the idea. The place I went was run by the Mormon Church.
Oh, wow.
Not officially, but all the lead members were Mormons, and we ran by Mormon rules. We weren't allowed to spend any money on Sundays. We weren't allowed to say God, for example.
Oh, wow.
Utah is by far the most common state for these kind of programs, because they have the least, like, several states have started to regulate, essentially to say, like, you have to submit to regular inspections and whatnot, and have teachers that have qualifications that teachers would need, or medical qualifications of wilderness rehab places. But Utah has, for years now, steadfastly fought putting any regulations in on what you can do in, you know, a rehab program or a religious school. So these places, essentially, once the parents sign over, in some cases, the parents sign over actual custody, or at least they sign a contract saying, I'll let the child be here for X amount of time. So once the parents sign their kid over, these places have legal rights over them. So even if you escape, the police just have to send you back, unless they, you know, catch on to some evidence of abuse.
And the Utah thing is, it's not a coincidence that the Mormons ended up there, and that, you know, there are some sort of religious extremist groups that live there, and that these schools are there, right? It's just the state laws are pretty permissive and tend to look the other way on things like that, right?
Yeah, and I think Utah has a pretty high population of people who are, compared to the rest of the nation, who are more like fundamentalist in their religious attitudes, and thus, especially since, like, you have to think most of the people who vote to keep these places, they're not thinking about them being like a nightmare place where kids are tortured. They're hearing them described as like, no, this is a religious school for troubled kids, drug addicts and whatnot. You know, they're going to get what they need because this will help them. These people don't actually know what's going on in these schools. And, you know, oftentimes, the woman we wrote our first article on the troubled teeth program with, Tori Jane, her grandparents who sent her there and paid for it, you know, went to their graves thinking that they saved her life by doing this, even though she, to this day, has horrific
PTSD.
Anxiety and depression as a result of what happened there.
Yeah. Now, Sarah, what did you know going in? How was the kind of bill of goods pitched to you by this consultant?
Oh, boy. Well, part of it was my parents didn't want me at Wilderness, and they didn't want me in an institutional setting because they thought it wouldn't be good for me. So this was sold as, they call it family-style treatment. So it was in a house in, like, the middle of nowhere in Utah, and it was billed as the kinder, gentler version of going to a mental hospital, basically. There were adults that lived in the house that were called our house parents. We actually took a visit to go see the house, and I know for sure now, having been on the other side of those visits, that you are under strict orders to look very happy, to say nothing bad about anything, and to avoid answering any questions, if at all possible, to refer the parents or the kids back to the staff. It was sold as like I was going to be living a family away from my family. It was supposed to be like an affectionate, warm situation.
And why would this family be any better at dealing with the issues that you were going through than your own family? Was it just the idea that they were sort of trained and were able to kind of focus on it full time?
Yeah, we were not told that the house parents and the day-to-day staff wouldn't have any sort of therapy training at all, not even like a basic psychology course or being a social worker. So the way my parents and I were sold it was that I was going to be having therapeutic interactions with the people I lived with, and it would be kind of a double duty therapist/family model. And instead, it turned out that I believe their reasoning for having house parents was basically you need a straight couple to live with, was the subtext.
Oh.
And they don't have to have training. It was you need a mom and a dad at the head of this thing.
Is this treated as like a reform for gay and lesbian teenagers as well?
They were not allowed to. However, I'm bisexual, and my therapist, she wanted to make sure, my therapist from home, who was cool with it, wanted to make sure that I wasn't going to run into problems, because she had heard stories from other girls she worked with who had come home. And so we actually talked to the board and talked about, do you have any anti-gay policies? Do you have any, like, do you have a stance on this? And they, no, everything's fine. And then I got there, and I was informed that I was not allowed to say that I was bisexual and that I was being sexually inappropriate and talking about sex, which was not allowed. So I ended up actually having to petition the board, the same board that said it was going to be okay for me to be there, to be allowed to say the sentence, I am bisexual.
Wow.
So it's not technically against the rules, but basically once you get there, the house parents control everything. They make the rules. And if they don't like gay people, or they don't like swearing, or wearing two earrings in your ear, you don't get to do it.
It sounds like these are for-profit parents, essentially.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, there are places where you spend like $8,000, $9,000 a month to keep your kid in
these programs.
That was one
of the places I was at.
Yeah.
Wow. Yeah. So just take me back to the initial decision. First of all, do you live in Utah?
I live in California.
Oh, you live in California. So it is almost like going away to college. Like you went to a different state to this family in Utah. And once you made the decision, you flew out there with your parents and kind of got adjusted. And
when we were searching for schools, we had visited that one, and it was the place that seemed the most, you know, safe and for me, because I was in on it in the sense that I was going and I was allowed to help or where I was going.
Many of the kids who go to these programs, there are services that you can hire who will abduct your child for you and take them to these places. One of them is the Center for Safe Youth. That's just the name of the service. If you look at the way they advertise their services, it's stuff like, we've safely and compassionately escorted thousands of children, teens, young adults. We are prepared to appropriately interact with each individual, whether they present with compliance, reticence, or outright defiance. And what that means in a lot of cases is that they give you a choice of you can either comply and you'll get a plane trip and it'll be quick, or you can fight and we'll essentially put you in restraints and drive you in a van for days to this place. They advise parents not to tell kids ahead of time that they're coming. So often the first time the kid realizes they're going to a troubled teen facility is when they wake up in the middle of the night with strange men in their room restraining them and taking them into a van. That's how a lot of kids get to these facilities. So this is just a direct quote from the Center for Safe Youth's page from their FAQ. Should I tell my child in advance, even the night before? No. Prior knowledge will only serve to increase the child's anxiety, heighten defenses, and force the child into a bad decision, such as running away.
That's
just them saying, don't tell your kid that they're going to be abducted in the night. It'll just confuse them.
These are professional kidnappers. I mean,
they're professional kidnappers.
And I urge everybody who is around a computer while listening to this to Google Center for Safe Youth or just go to safeyouth.com and click around. It's really surreal.
Yeah.
There's a bunch of pictures of really sad children, but I would like to kind of continue with Sarah's story. So when did you kind of realize that the bill of goods that you had been promised was not what you were getting?
I actually have one specific moment where I woke up kind of after that and went, oh, this is not a good place. It was within my first month there, near the end of it, and I was sitting in the kitchen, which overlooked kind of a living room area with a TV. And I was sitting nearby one of the staff, and her name was Abby. She looks over at me and she says, hey, watch this. And she calls to one of the other girls and says, hey, Andrea, there's a ding on the TV cabinet. You broke it. And Andrea looks at her and she goes, no, I didn't. We're both sitting right here, Abby. I'm not even near the TV. And Abby says, no, you did it. You have to take your consequence. And Andrea kind of made a face and took it and walked away. And I'm new, so I have no idea what's going on. And I turned to Abby and I said, but we're both sitting here. We both know she didn't do it. And Abby said, yeah, I know. But this way, I know if she's going to do what I tell her to do. I'll give her all the points back and then some. We were on a points-based system.
Oh,
but
wow.
I need to know that she's going to accept consequences.
These staff members are just young people who just work in this industry, basically, like running homes like this?
Yeah, some of them were students who were getting in experience hours. And then some of them were just hired like a job. One of our AFT's associate family teachers, which is what they were called, was an ex-soccer player. One of them was a diplomat's daughter who was just looking for a paycheck.
Huh.
Another one was saving up for her wedding and that she was only going to work for like 6 months.
And these are the people who are in control of your safety and sort of what happens to you. What does accept your consequences mean?
Accepting consequences meant that if they told you that you had done something, you had broken a rule, you had said something you shouldn't, you had to say, okay, we worked off a points-based system, so they would give you corrections or punishment, and you would have to go, it would be writing a paper, doing some chores. They like to have us go outside and clear brush because there are no manual labor laws in Utah for kids. So we would end up going outside and gardening for 3 hours to make up for saying, oh my God. We weren't allowed to swear. The only quote-unquote bad word we were allowed to say was crap. Shit, damn, hell, fuck, God. You got giant consequences for saying them. Or if a staff thought you said them, because the accepting consequences was you weren't allowed to argue at all. And if you argued, even to say, but that's not what I did, you got more consequences on top of what you had already gotten. Basically, the system was to get you to shut up and just do what they said.
What were some other consequences that you had to do other than clearing brush?
The clearing brush was pretty bad because we lived on a giant property in the middle of nowhere, and you would go outside and with your bare hands, you would have to be pulling basically a whole trash bag of weeds.
It's like hard manual labor.
Yeah, and then there were papers. We would have to, say, clean the bathrooms. The worst was usually anything that had to do with outside. Sometimes we had to shovel snow in the winter. They didn't make us do anything egregious. It was that we were doing it so much at the drop of a hat and without, say, gloves when we're going out and working with things that have brambles. Oh, they also made us clean the window wells, which had black widow nests in them.
Oh, Jesus Christ. Sorry, I accept my consequences for saying that. If you had gone to the house parents and sort of been like, Abby's being a crazy bitch, like what would have happened?
Oh, I would have gotten in horrible trouble.
From Abby or from the
parents? Oh, no, not from Abby, from my house parents. The rules essentially were staff is always right. If staff is wrong, see rule one.
Wow.
There was no appeal system. I occasionally would complain to my actual therapist who came in a couple times a week, and she would move things behind the scenes for me because she was the only decent human being there.
Huh.
But other than that, there was nothing to do.
And what was keeping you there?
Part of it was we were in the middle, literal middle of nowhere. We had some girls who ran away. When I was there, there were, I believe, 4 runaway attempts. One of them was my roommate, which was not fun for me.
Did she tell you she was going to leave?
No, but they thought she did. So I was basically under surveillance for like a week and a half, where they just constantly watched me to make sure I wasn't doing anything I shouldn't be doing.
Wow.
But there were alarms on the house, for one thing. During the day, there weren't, but at night, everything was alarmed. And then during the day, it was, where do you go? If you run away, you're in Salt Lake City, which is the absolute worst place in the world to be homeless. And then once the cops find you, since your parents have signed you over, they don't call your parents. And if you try to payphone your parents, what do you say to them? I ran away from the place that you're spending all this money to keep me at. Come get me. My parents would have called them too.
Like if you said, they won't let me say that I'm bisexual, they are making me do hard manual labor, you think your parents would have just been like, well, it's good for you, tough love?
No, I think the problem there was they really did indoctrinate us all to the point where we weren't allowed contact with our families for the first, I believe, 3 months without supervision, and we couldn't write them letters that weren't first opened and read by staff to approve everything in them. And they gave every parent like a talk about how your child is going to want to come home, they're going to make stuff up, they're going to exaggerate, you need to stay strong. And by the time your three-month period is over, I mean, I was a 16-year-old girl. An adult told me to do things, and after a certain amount of time, I got so beaten down that it didn't occur to me to tell my parents anything, because I got told every single day, your parents aren't going to help you. We are in charge of your life. Because also, they told us what we could wear. They told us when we got to go to sleep. They told us what to eat. They told us when to eat, what music we listened to, what TV we watched, what books we read. So it got to the point where it's like, you genuinely believe that they can do anything because they can. And when you're 16, it never occurred to me after that period to be like, Mom and Dad, here's what's actually happening.
My last question, and then I'll turn it over to Robert to see if he has any questions. But first of all, what was the food like? And did they...
Oh, God awful.
Oh, really?
Yeah, we cooked it all, and most of the girls were not good cooks, so it ended up being like a lot of Stouffer's frozen vegetable lasagna, because they had nutrition requirements, but what that meant was throw a bag of frozen vegetables on the table. We had, I believe, $200 a week for 10 girls, 2 staff, and usually 3 or 4 extra staff at every meal.
$200 to eat for... 18
people. So,
yep.
Yeah.
Jesus, that's incredible. I don't know, it's so Dickensian. What was their taste of music like? Probably pretty good, right?
Oh, wonderful. they did this one ridiculous thing where anytime a song came on the radio that had quote-unquote bad words that weren't bleep, they made us cover our ears.
Oh, no.
And if we got caught singing along, we got in trouble.
Oh, Jesus.
So it was a lot of pop music that we were only supposed to listen to half of. I remember getting in trouble for singing Usher's Yeah. We weren't allowed to sing certain parts of the chorus, and I got caught singing Yeah while doing chores.
Yeah. Well, that is the source of all evil in the world, is Usher lyrics. Can I ask what your relationship's like with your parents now?
It suffered for a while because I was angry with them, but so brainwashed that I didn't really know why I was angry. We started talking about what happened about 3 years ago, and it's been a lot better since I opened up and told them the actual story, and their response was sheer horror.
Oh,
my
really?
Mom, every time we speak about it, she's like, I'm so sorry, Sarah. I wish I had known. I never would have sent you.
Is the place still open?
It is. Oh, fun fact. Actually, recently, a couple years ago, one of the house parents was arrested and put in jail for molesting one of the girls.
Are you serious?
I am, yeah. I had a Google alert set up, and I got a hit, and I went to go look, and my first thought was, oh, okay, this is the thing I've been waiting for. I knew something like this was going to happen. The way it was set up, and my house parent was kind of a creep, the guy, we weren't allowed to hug each other for a while, no physical contact, and since I like hugs, they made getting hugged a reward for me. And he was always the one who gave the hug.
Ew.
So it was just set up so that anybody who wanted to abuse power would be able to really, really, really easily. And since they didn't vet the people they hired other than, are you a straight couple with no, you know, jail time? Okay, you're in. I was just waiting for somebody to do something.
This was the main house parent? The main house dad?
Yeah, it was the guy who lived in the house. He started it when she was there, and it got found out because he had been writing her explicit letters, and her father found it after she came home.
Oh, my God.
So he carried it on after she left the house.
Robert, do you have any last questions? Sorry, I kind of...
Yeah, one thing I wanted to get into, because I know we're going to hear it from probably our other source as well. One major way that these places kind of maintain control is they use students who have been kind of successfully brainwashed, who have been with the program a while, to enforce a lot of discipline on other students. Like I've heard, like you already mentioned that when you were kind of looking at places, they had you meet with some kids who were in one of the programs and do like a very catered business. I'm wondering if you had anything to say about sort of how students are used to enforce some of the discipline on other students, to tattle on them and whatnot.
They had a perfect system set up called peer and self-reporting, which was if you had broken a rule, you needed to self-report. You needed to go narc yourself out. And if you had seen someone else breaking a rule, you needed to go tell on them. And if you saw someone else see someone else break a rule, you need to go tell on both of them. And the person who saw but didn't tell first gets in trouble just as much as the person who broke the rule. So we lived in constant fear of if you ever broke a rule, people had to report on you because they would get in trouble if it came out that they did. So even if you didn't want rat out other girls, you kind of had to because you would end up in just as much trouble as they were.
Sounds like the perfect environment for somebody who's suffering with mental health issues to...
Oh, I had so many trust issues when I came home.
Oh, my God.
I would look at people and just think, what are you trying to get me to admit? Are you trying to trap me here? Because they would pull us in and ask us if we had any self-report semi-regularly. Sometimes they did it when they knew something, and sometimes they just did it to shake our tree and see if they could get anything out of us.
Don't ask me what you know is true. Don't have to tell you I love your precious heart. I was standing.
All right, that was our episode on to Footnotes. We're listening to Never Tear Us Apart, of course, by NXS, which is a classic 80s song that actually raises an issue that was sort of on my mind this entire time. The parents who are sending these kids away voluntarily, even though you would think that parents would never want to be apart from their kids. I think that is the truly strange thing here. I think in 90% of the world's cultures, that would be unheard of, would seem like the act of a complete lunatic, that you could take people's children away from them. For most cultures, you can take people's children away from them when you rip them from their cold, dead embrace. And that was something I came across during the episode last year, actually, last year's most popular episode, Stuff White People Don't Understand About Racism. I opened that episode up reading from a list of stereotypes other races have about white people. And one of the ones that I don't know if I mentioned, but that stood out to me as coming sort of completely out of left field was the stereotype that white people don't love their kids as much as they love their dogs, or at least don't discipline their children. I've been thinking about that a lot since I read that, and especially in the past couple months. I think it surprised me at the time because, first of all, that was never a thing for me growing up. I don't know if my mom was just different from other moms. My dad grew up in the worst neighborhood in Philadelphia, so maybe he never got that part of rich white culture, because not disciplining me and my sisters was never a problem for them. But I've been running into it a lot lately, this thing where rich white parents don't discipline their kids. In a recent PE pitch, we heard from a nanny from a family whose parents would come to her each morning with a list of things the kids had done wrong the night before, and her job was to punish them for it. because the parents didn't want to. Basically, like, reverse Santa Claus. Parents would be like, so she didn't eat her dessert last night? And, you know, the night before, they'd be like, eat your food. Don't make us tell Jen. Jen's gonna be mad at you. Not us, of course, because we're your friends, buddy. And I don't know where in the culture this comes from, necessarily. This not wanting to bother with the emotionally taxing work of having conflict with your children. It makes me think of Amy Poehler's character in Mean Girls. But it does seem to be something we see in these windows into people's lives these personal experience articles give us. When we get windows into the lives of upper-class white people, this seems to be something we run up against. Sort of wanting your children to be someone else's problem. That seems to be what's at work behind this entire industry. It's exploiting something in parents that's willing to let their kids go, something anomalous to that particular part of that particular culture. So anyways, get your shit together. Get our shit together, white people, I guess is what I'm saying. That's it. That's been our episode. You can follow me at Jack_O'Brien. You can follow engineer Brett at Brett Rader. R-A-D-E-R. If you like the music, by the way, that we play, you should follow the Cracked playlist on Spotify. Just search Cracked Podcast on Spotify. Thanks everyone who came out to the live show, the live Oscar thing we did this past week. It was a blast. And coming up, I'm thrilled to announce that Rom.com is about to debut its third season. You can catch the premiere right here on Cracked on Wednesday, February 10th. And then another episode every Wednesday for 4 weeks. Josie, Max, Elise, and Blake all back to help you navigate through the increasingly ridiculous world of online dating. It stars Caitlin Large, Michael Swaim, C. Ashley Caldwell, and Daniel O'Brien. So catch up on the first two seasons now, and then come back here February 10th for the premiere of another great season. We'll be back next week with more podcast. I'll talk to you guys then. I was standing, you were there, two worlds collided, and they could never tear us apart. For a thousand years, if I hurt you, I make wine from your tears. I told you that we could fly, 'cause we all have wings, but some of us don't know why. Hey guys, remember, Valentine's Day can be an awkward time to be in a new relationship. Any gift you get them can seem like too much or not enough. A sock, just one of them, would seem like not enough. But a sock subscription is the gift that shows you put in some thought without smothering them. Foot Cardigan is a gift that guarantees at least one more good makeout sesh. So get 10% off any Foot Cardigan subscription by going to footcardigan.com and entering cracked16, that is cracked, C-R-A-C-K-E-D, 16. Enter those things at checkout and you'll save Valentine's Day, you'll save your relationship, and you will save humanity all at once.
Hey, Earwolf listeners, this is Hillary Frank from The Longest Shortest Time, where we ask the hard-hitting questions.
What will happen if I don't have a shadow? What does the tooth fairy do with her tooth?
Am I the real Batman?
Who's Jesus' grandparents?
John Willis, age 3, bringing out the big guns. I'm actually, like, rattled.
The Longest Shortest Time. It's the parenting show for everyone. Listen at longestshortesttime.com, earwolf.com, or wherever you listen to podcasts.
This has been an Earwolf production, executive produced by Scott Aukerman, Adam Sachs, and Chris Bannon. For more information and content, visit earwolf.com.